Blog Talk Radio.
Texas on Saturday, October 27th. This is day number 300 of 2012. We're really coming down. There's, you know, this weekend and next weekend, and then we're going to have an election. So it's coming extremely fast. Election day, by the way, will be day 311. So we are within 10 or 11 days of election day. Tonight we're going to be talking with James Yardley. James is a friend of the program. He's a contributor to the American Thinker. And we're going to be talking about Libya and this incredible scandal that we find ourselves in. It's an absolutely horrible situation that the country is in, or that the Obama administration, frankly, has put the country. Four people are dead. There's all kinds of questions, more questions and more questions, and no one seems to have any answers. Let me just say thank you to the management of Blog Talk Radio for featuring our program today. We're going to be on the front page of Blog Talk Radio all of Sunday, so we appreciate those of you who are listening to us for the first time. You know, we try to give you a good program with a lot of good and fun type of program. We like to have great guests, like tonight, James Yardley, a contributor to the American Thinker. We usually have people like Bill Katz of Urgent Agenda. We have many friends at the American Thinker. We have many of them on our show, because that's such a good website, and we rely on a lot of what they do over at the website. So we're going to get started. Before we do, though, we're going to hear from our sponsor for the first segment tonight. That's Avalon Professional Translation here in Dallas, Texas.
Sending the right message in multiple languages is easy with Avalon Professional Translation Services. Avalon provides document and web translation in 62 languages. In addition, access to 140 languages is just a phone call away any day of the year. Events, even court depositions, no problem for Avalon. Call 972-404-1213 or go to avalontranslation.com. Avalon Professional Translation Services, global communications made easy.
Yes, exactly right. And we have a link to Avalon Professional Translation and the show information. Just click on that, and that'll take you to the website. We're going to be chatting with James Yardley, contributor to the American Thinker, about this Libya crisis, but I thought maybe we just touch base tonight a little bit on this day in history, and there's some interesting things on this day. 1904, the New York City subway was opened. I think everybody has had an experience at the New York City subway. I certainly did. A good one, actually. I think it's a pretty good subway. It gets you around New York City quite well, but you do have some characters that will often share the seat with you in the New York City subway. You got to understand that before you take the subway. On this day in 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis came to an end. There was a settlement between the United States and the Soviet Union, and the missiles left Cuba. And on a more happy note, and this is for all the Red Sox fans who must be angry this year that the Red Sox didn't make the postseason, well, on this day in 2004, the Red Sox won the World Series, and it was then the first time they had won the World Series since 1918. So congratulations 8 years later to the Red Sox. That was a great moment when the Red Sox won the World Series in 2004, and the curse of the Bambino was finally put to an end. Let's say hello to James Yardley. How are you, James?
Not too bad, and it's just Jim.
All right, Jim. Always a pleasure to say hello to you. We've had you on the show before, but as I mentioned, we'll probably have some new listeners tonight, and I just wanted you to talk a little bit about yourself, Jim.
Well, I'm a retired financial executive. I was financial controller for a number of large manufacturing companies. Been around the block in business, and spent two fun-filled years in Vietnam, fulfilling my requirement to the military. I have two kids, two grandkids, two grandsons, and they're both very bright children, so I had the opportunity to rub it into my kids that every parent in every nation, no matter what their race, what their religion, what their creed, has said this to their kids at some time in their life. I hope you have a kid just like you when you grow up. Well, mine both did. Ah, I was so happy.
Well, that's great. And I remember the last time we spoke that you said the reason you got into writing is because after you retired, your wife was so crazy having you around, she just said, if you don't do something, I'm going to go nuts, right?
No, she said she divorced me.
Okay, that's right.
And, you know, I'm not a guy who's going to put up with that lightly. I just looked at her and said, yes, dear.
Right, exactly. So that's we've all benefited then from that moment because you've been writing over at The American Thinker, and if she had never said that to you, you'd probably never write.
Probably not. I usually leave that to my daughter.
Very
She's
good.
A professional writer.
Oh, really? Okay. She's an author or?
Novelist, yeah.
Oh, wow. That's cool. What are some of her novels? Give her a plug.
Haven't got an idea. She won't let me read them. She writes romance novels for, like, Harlequin. And she said, don't read it, Dad. You'll just be upset. Okay, fine. Are you making money, kid? I'm happy for you.
Well, I think that, you know, I heard someday there was a lady at our church who did that, or wanted to do that, I guess, write these romantic novels. That's a tremendous market. I had no idea how big it is.
It's absolutely enormous. But like all the print media, they're going through a tough transition phase right now. Where is it going to be published on Kindle? Is it going to be published in paper? In, you know, traditional book form. And the publishers are not really sure what they're going to do. So that makes it a little tougher for writers. And a lot of writers can self-publish e-books with very little expenditure. So there's even more competition for the reader's dollar right now.
No, and I know that for a fact because I'm in the process of publishing a book myself, and it's a lot easier to do it now. The self-publish option is out there, but the number of people who are buying what they call e-books, or you just download the book, whatever, Kindle, I guess it's the name of one
right.
of the services, Amazon, I think Kindle is their service, but the number of people who are doing that is tremendous. Tremendous.
Oh, yeah.
And it's sort of a good news, bad news situation. It's probably good news for some of the authors. Now you can self-publish. You know, you don't have to worry about, you know, having to obtain your, you know, you don't have to sit there and send it to 10,000 publishers and have them turn it down. You know, like, I guess sort of the way it used to be. Now you can actually pretty much do it yourself. Now, of course, you're not guaranteed anything as far as success. But you're not guaranteed success the other way anyway, particularly if you're a new author. Now, if you're an established author, you're going to get a big advance, but that doesn't really happen to many people anyways. Well, tell your daughter we wish her a lot of success.
I shall.
Please do that. If she's listening to the show, we wish you a lot of success. Well, let's talk a little bit.
I hope she becomes the next Tom Clancy. You know,
That's not a bad. That means your Christmas reunions are going to be very happy if she does that. You're going to be so happy to see her. Every Christmas is when she shows up. But let's talk a little bit about, kind of begin our chat tonight. You wrote an article back in 2011, which, interesting, I mean, you saw a lot of this coming, which I it's fascinating. We have a link to the article in the show information. When people click on your name, they'll get to the article. But this was about a year or so ago, and you saw a lot of this coming before we get to Libya, but you saw a lot of this coming in the Middle East, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, as I pointed out in the article, a cry for democracy, a yearning for democratic government, is not built into human DNA. When Europeans first came to America, It started with the Mayflower Compact. That was the first evidence of, okay, let's all agree on how we're going to run things. And we spent 150 years after that working on a democratic system. The New England town halls, you know, and the House of Burgesses in Virginia and so on. We spent 150 years learning how to do it and learning how to rule ourselves. And we and European countries have gone into the Middle East and expected to say, oh, we'll set you up a constitution, you'll be fine, with absolutely no background in that form of government. And the folks who live in the Middle East are largely illiterate, dominated by a religion that says if it's not in the Quran, you don't need to know it. As a matter of fact, if it's not in the Quran, it's probably blasphemy. So you're in trouble if you do read it. With that kind of background, democracy was bound to fail. There was no context for these people to go, oh, okay, I know what you mean. And the democracy movement, if you will, the Arab Spring, was a facade of language that wannabe dictators used to gain support from Western nations, because these wannabes told the West what they wanted to hear. They suckered all the Western powers. And now you have President Morsi in Egypt and the Muslim Brotherhood. I found out recently that the Muslim Brotherhood, the philosophical grandfather of the Muslim Brotherhood, is a man named, and I may say this incorrectly, Sayyid Khatib. And he was a mullah in Egypt. And he was executed ultimately by Nasser. He was also a philosophical guiding light for Osama bin Laden. So when you get Clapper, General Clapper, the National Intelligence Director, saying that the Muslim Brotherhood is a secular organization, you wonder, what planet are you talking about?
Yeah, that's like saying that the YMCA is a secular organization, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, or the Knights of Columbus, or, you know, the Southern Baptist, or whatever. I mean, yeah, I have no idea why he said that, but maybe you agree with me, but one of the differences between our experience, as you were saying, it took us 150 years to figure it out, but there were certain things that we had that they don't have in the Middle East. One of them is, of course, private property, which is essential to have any kind of stable system. They, you know, we also had a sense of respect or more diversity as far as religion. You know, they weren't killing people because they weren't of this faith or that faith. So I think that maybe
wouldn't go quite that far, Silvio.
Don't forget, many states in the initial federal system, the state created a state religion. You know, you couldn't live here unless you're a Presbyterian. Catholics were banished to Maryland, you know, that type of thing.
Right.
There was a tremendous amount of religious bigotry. If you remember back to the election of 1960 with Jack Kennedy running, there was still a tremendous undercurrent of anti-Catholic bias. So it didn't go away. It's not like, oh, we've got all this diversity now. Look at the last time Mitt Romney ran.
Right.
How big Mormonism was.
Right.
As a talking point. So.
Well, all right. So I take it back. It wasn't perfect, but I do think there was a much greater sense of tolerance than what you see over in the Middle East. But I think the point that, you're making, which is an excellent point, is that, you know, these people, we thought they were ready for democracy just because they had elections or because they told us so. And we're kind of learning that that's not the way it is. Now, over the last couple of months, you know, we've had this situation in Libya, and I wanted to get into that with you tonight, you know, to see what you think is going on there. How bad of a scandal do you think it is?
As a political scandal, I think it surpasses Watergate.
Well, this is the truth. I mean, I feel the same way, but of course, we ought to, in all fairness to the media, we ought to remember that the media didn't immediately go on Watergate. I mean, Watergate was in June of 72, and it really didn't become a scandal for President Nixon until the next spring. In fact, it didn't have much of an impact on the 72 election. So maybe the media will come around, but there's four dead people. There are all kinds of problems here, all kinds of questions, and President Obama is still telling TV networks, the ones who are asking him, that we're looking into this, and, you know, I'll let you know as soon as I have all the information. Well, it's been almost 6 weeks. What more information does he need, Jim?
He'll find it right after November 6th.
Well, that's it. That's you're exactly right.
It's delaying tactics. He's trying to run out the clock. And that is a pretty standard procedure. You recommended an article written by Bill Kristol.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, 10 questions he'd like to ask the president. And I looked him over and I thought, Bill, you're never going to get an answer.
Right.
Never.
Let me just quickly tell the listeners about this article, just because we have a link to it on the show information. This is something that just came out today, so some of the listeners may not be aware of this. It's the Weekly Standard. Bill Kristol is one of the editors there, and this is in what they call the blog, and he wrote an article called 10 Questions for the White House, questions about this particular scandal, and Jim was just getting into that, and I agree with you. I think they're running out the clock, but here's the one question that I found most interesting of the 10, and that is, did he speak with CIA Director Petraeus? I mean, was Petraeus involved in all of this? I would like to know that, too. Because I would want to believe that Petraeus would have acted differently than the White House. You know, I would like to believe that. I don't know what you think of that, Jim.
Well, I'd like to believe in Santa Claus, too.
Okay.
But you don't get to be a four-star general unless you have a very strong sense of the politics of the situation. And that's not in any way disparaging David Petraeus's contributions to the nation over his career. But politics plays a very important role when you're at the senior levels in the military, just as it does in any organization. But as I said, you're never going to get an answer. For one thing, he's going to try to run out the clock. For another thing, looking at these questions and looking at the situation where We keep using the word terrorism. It's an act of war, a fluid war. We're not up against a nation state, but it's a war nonetheless. The president, for once, would be perfectly reasonable in saying that, no, I'm going to exert executive privilege. We're not going to talk about this any more than Winston Churchill or Harry Truman or FDR, for that matter, would have discussed war matters. Okay? He's got a valid excuse. It's lame, but it's a valid excuse legally. But you're never going to see this. And after the election, should he lose? Yes, it's a scandal, but you won't see anything in the mainstream media or very few other places other than people that are dying to get something on him to make him feel guilty. But I don't think the man's capable of that. So I don't think you'll ever see any of those questions answered unless someone like Darrell Issa opens a hearing after January of next year, after January 20th, when Obama's no longer president.
Right. Well, I think he's also betting that if he loses, my sense that he's betting that if he loses, the Romney administration won't go back at them, because we just don't do that in the United States. You know, we don't go back to the previous administration. Maybe that's what he's betting also. And he's betting that, he's also betting that if he wins, Jim, that somehow, you know, they can get around this. I don't think they can, though. I think if he does win, they're going to have to answer some of these questions eventually, especially if they have a Republican Senate, you know, and a Republican Congress. But one of the other questions I found most interesting, I think this is the one that probably, actually, this is a combination of two or three questions, but I think this is the area, Jim, where this has become such a political problem for President Obama, and that is the idea that you had people crying for help and no help came, even though there was a C-130, one of these gunships that could have been there, Jim, in a fairly short time. And the AC-130, I think that's what it is, which is the gunships. These gunships could have been there in a fairly reasonable time, and they could have at least given the people in the embassy a chance to maybe be rescued, or at least driven back some of the attackers. I think politically that's why it's hurting him so much, because Americans were killed and they were crying out for help. Help was around and help never came, Jim.
Absolutely. But he has never been particularly concerned with the deaths of anyone other than his own family. The drone strikes end up with a lot of collateral damage. They may say, we are striking Joe Blow because he's a leader in Al-Qaeda. But, gee, his wife was there, his kids were there, the neighbor came over to borrow some sugar. They all died. Collateral damage is not a major source of concern for Barack Obama. And he looks at the death of these men as simply collateral damage. I mean, he phrased it as there's going to be a bump in the road. Really, Barry? Four deaths is a bump in the road? I found that absolutely appalling.
Right, and the other thing, too, and I think Bill Kristol is getting to this in one of the questions, too, you know, he was in the White House, as I understand, when all of this was going on. I mean, the time frame of this event is that, and I'm just going to just look at this article. It says the president was in the White House. The attack began at 2:40 Eastern time until the end of combat sometime after 9. So the president was in the White House when all of this was going on. So it's not like they woke him up at 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, he was there in the White House. He was apparently meeting with the vice president, the secretary of defense. I just have a hard time believing, Jim, that if the ambassador of the United States is killed, that they wouldn't interrupt the president, I don't care who he's talking to, and say, Mr. President, the ambassador in Libya has just been killed. The embassy's under attack. You know, your national security team is recommending a military response to save these people. I just have a hard time that he wouldn't have been approached like that. And then on top of it, Jim, he gets on a plane the next day and he goes to Vegas for a fundraiser? I mean, come on. I mean, what is this guy thinking, Jim?
I need to get reelected because I really like this job. I get a neat, shiny plane. I can spend $1 million on a steak dinner and have Beyonce perform. That's what he's thinking.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I don't disagree with you on that. But he's, I mean, look at these interviews that he's doing, Jim. MTV, he was on, I guess, one of the night shows recently. And he's not addressing any of these problems. Now, some of the local reporters, interestingly enough, are asking him questions. But his answer is always the same. You know, well, we're finding out exactly what happened. I can tell you, as I've said over the last couple of months, the minute I found out something was happening, I gave 3 very clear directives. Well, who did he give them to? That's another question that Bill Kristol would like to know. I mean, if he gave out these directives, then somebody didn't follow his command, Jim. I mean, if the president says, you know, I want these people protected, well, they were not protected. So that worries me that his orders were not carried out as the president, Jim.
timeline. He gave that order, supposedly, after their deaths. It was meant to be a corrective action. The question then becomes, okay, how many Marines were transferred to trouble spots, if you will, to protect embassy employees and our ambassadors? Not who disobeyed his order prior to the deaths. It would be post, you know, okay, what have you done to improve things? If you gave those orders and you had a month, where's the improvement?
Yes, I mean, I don't know, but I mean, that's a very legitimate question. But do you think that, do you think he will get those questions here? Because in the next 10 days, we know he's not going to have a press conference. I mean, really, I think the smartest political thing or move for President Obama, I mean, I agree with you. He's very concerned about his reelection. But I think the smartest political thing for the president to have done is to have held a press conference and say, look, we're going to talk about this, and ask me any question you want to ask. And I think a lot of these issues could have been addressed in a press conference and much of it put behind him. But the problem is these things just keep coming out. They just keep coming out, and as I said, we have more questions than answers every single day, Jim.
Well, you alluded to Watergate. This is exactly the same thing that I thought back then. Nixon could have gone in front of the public and said, a couple of my people went off the reservation. I'd like to apologize to the DNC. I would like to apologize to George McGovern. They were not doing this under any orders, and they will be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. He would have been golden, not hounded out of office.
Right.
Obama's got the same situation, and he made the same dumb choice. I'll stonewall it. And
now,
even if the mainstream media doesn't jump all over him, places like Fox, places like the American Thinker, are going to keep talking about it and talking about it and talking about it, and it will seep into the national consciousness. Something isn't right, and he's at fault.
Well, I'll tell you something, Jim. I agree 100% with you. This is really, you know, this is burning at Fox. You watch Fox, and there it is. Talk radio, very much so. Obviously, the American Thinker. But I saw a show the other night on, this is CNBC, Larry Kudlow, and he was talking about it. You know, this is NBC, and Larry Kudlow was talking about it. So I think, a lot of people are talking about it. There's an editorial in the Boston Herald. I don't know if that's a liberal or a conservative newspaper, but
it's conservative.
It is.
Boston
okay.
Globe is liberal.
Okay, so it's a conservative paper, but they have an editorial called Incompetence in Benghazi. So it's out there. You know, people are reading about it, and I don't think he may not give this press conference. He may try to get away with it, Jim, but I think enough people are out there are getting the information that it's got to be hurting him. And I told you off the air that Gallup, he's dropped 7 points in Gallup in the job approval, and that's got to be related to this. The Des Moines Register, a newspaper that had not endorsed a Republican since 1972. In fact, you were talking about Richard Nixon. That's the last time they endorsed a Republican in 1972. They will be officially endorsing Romney tomorrow in their edition. Now, they're focusing more on the economy than anything else, but that's a pretty big step. So I think it is hurting him, maybe not so much because the media is getting involved, because people like you and me are talking about it, the American Thinker is talking about it, talk radio is talking about it, and yeah, Fox News is talking about it too, and some of the other networks are starting to talk about it a little bit. But let me raise one last topic, Jim, about this, because I was talking to Clayton Kramer last night on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you know Clayton. I think he's written over at the American Thinker, too. If you don't know him personally, maybe you've heard of him.
Yes,
I know. He brought up an extremely interesting point. Now, for some of the listeners who may not know Clayton, I just want to give you a quick background about him. He's He's a U.S. history teacher in Idaho, and he's a businessman, and he's very strongly involved in the Second Amendment campaign, you know, to protect the Second Amendment. And Clinton last night brought up the idea that the reason that the Obama White House is so sensitive about this is that there was a gun-running operation going on in the Middle East where we were giving guns to some of these rebels, but maybe not the good rebels, if you know what I mean, and that this gun-running operation is going to explode if this thing is investigated, a little bit like Iran-Contra. The big difference is Iran-Contra was, you know, very small compared to this. Are you familiar with that story at all?
No, not at all, to be honest. Although I have thought running guns to various tribal units in the Middle East would be a great solution to one of our biggest problems. Tribal rivalries in the Middle East go back thousands of years. They predate Islam by at least 1,500 to 2,000 years. They gleefully kill each other. You know, if you're willing to kill your daughter, you know, the guy in the next tribe is no problem. And I thought, you know, if we just keep giving them enough weaponry to keep that rivalry violent, they'll be too busy killing each other than to bother us. I know that sounds callous,
but it's the way it is.
It's kind of like, okay, that'd work.
No, it's the way it is. I think that's a very good point on your part. But I think that the point, and again, Clayton was speculating in all fairness, but what he was saying is that they didn't tell Congress that this was going on. A little bit like Fast and Furious. You know, they didn't tell, and that's what Clayton was talking about, that there could be a huge scandal around this gun-running operation that they didn't tell Congress about. And that's kind of where he was coming from. I just didn't know whether you had heard anything about that. But that's apparently part of the mix, and that's one of the reasons that...
But I wouldn't be a bit surprised.
No,
You look at Fast and Furious, the president didn't know anything about it. The attorney general didn't know anything about it.
The secretary...
Excuse me?
Yeah, no, you're exactly right.
You know, like, you guys are willing to ship guns to a group of narco-terrorists in an allied nation that is not only just allied, they're our neighbor. We share a border, and nobody cleared this with state. Nobody cleared this with the White House.
That's right.
And some flunky made the decision.
Yeah.
And he's still working there.
Right. That's a very good point. And, you know, you're talking about, you know, people forget that Fast and Furious, you know, we're putting guns over an international border.
Yeah.
Which is entirely different. I mean, it's one thing to have guns go from Texas to Oklahoma, but it's quite another thing when you go into another country and these guns fall in the hands of some of the deadliest cartels in the world. But there seems to be a pattern in this White House. Nobody ever tells the president anything, and I tend to agree with you. I think this is a tactic they use so that they can blame somebody else for it when the story breaks. Yeah.
But, Obama has coasted his entire life blaming someone else or blaming someone else for failures on his part. He wasn't given enough support. He wasn't given enough, you know, they were obstructionists. You know, whatever the excuse may be, it's never him. It's always someone else.
Right. He inherited a deficit. He inherited all of that. This is his...
I had a laugh before when you were saying that, well, in America, we don't blame the prior administration.
Well, until
George
him.
Bush did it for four
right.
years. We've been hearing that.
Right. Well, what I meant, I mean, legally, you didn't prosecute. That's more what I was talking about. But they certainly, the Obama administration certainly spent enough time talking about prosecuting some of those CIA people who were involved in the war on terror. Well, Jim, we're going to have to wrap it up. It's always a lot of fun to chat with you and catch up with you. And what's your next American Thinker article? Why don't you give us a heads up?
I've got about three that are in process, so and a lot of that's going to depend on Thomas saying, oh, this is a good one, Jim. I like this one. But I also write for Canada Free Press, and I just had an article published there 10 days ago, roughly, on immigration. and how we're all immigrants, and the reason that immigration needs to be controlled is that no country ever published ads, citizens wanted, inquire within. It's always motivated by the immigrant. They want to come here. And the question is, how do we choose which ones we allow in? Right now, you know, you sign up, you get on a waiting list, you know. Well, that's fine. You want to get in, but maybe whatever your skill is, we don't need. We may need 100,000 engineers. Okay, you're a pharmacist. We have plenty of those, thank you.
Well, isn't
you
that
can
what
stay
they do
online.
In Canada? Jim, isn't that what they do in Canada?
Yeah.
I mean, in Canada, to my knowledge, I'm not an expert on it, but I mean, what I've heard from my Canadian friends, that's what they do up there. I mean, they basically target immigration around their needs. So, you know, they don't import, you know, they're not importing English teachers, I guess, or French teachers into Canada. But if you have some knowledge of the oil industry, yeah, they need you.
You're in, yeah.
You're in because they need that in Alberta. So,
but I don't think we consider that. We get caught up in the whole diversity.
Right, or the family.
You know, we want
family.
Some from every country.
Right.
Why?
Well, not only that, but we do a lot of the family connection, which is, I think, how a lot of people come in because, you know, my uncle is here. He sponsors my other uncle. Next thing you know, you got the entire town coming over, even though they may not necessarily contribute or bring to the country what the country needs.
Exactly.
Interestingly enough, in our next segment, we're going to be talking about tuition and college degrees and a lot of people getting a lot of college degrees that aren't worth anything. So we're going to talk a little bit of that with our friend Aaron Clary. But, Jim, as always, a pleasure to say hello to you. Give my best to your wife. Tell your wife that she's the one who made you by forcing you to write.
Ah, no. She'll never believe that.
She'll never believe that? Well, if she's listening, I'll tell her. I said, you know, she got you into writing.
Okay. I will make sure she gets the message.
Please do. Please do.
Okay.
And thank you so much for sharing your information on Livia. You know, it's a complicated topic, but I think we learned a couple of things tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Have a good night.
All right, Jim. Jim Yardley, good friend of ours in New York, good friend of the show, and contributor to The American Thinker. And we were talking tonight a little bit about this Libya mess. It's worse and worse every single moment. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with Aaron Cleary right after this. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. Some good news today from Texas A&M. They beat up Auburn quite well this afternoon. Actually, they were playing tonight, and they had a pretty big score. So the Aggies, the Texas A&M Aggies, are doing quite well. Let's say hello to Aaron Cleary.
Hey, how you doing, Silvio?
Great. How is the weather up in Minnesota?
It's cool again, so probably drop a little freezing tonight, and but that's all right because I broke out the blankets and I'll turn up the heat.
And the firewood.
And the firewood, yes, correct. More carbon emissions, the better.
You know, our previous guest, Jim Yardley, is from upstate New York, and he was saying the same thing. You know, it's getting chilly up there. He went out to get some firewood. It's a little bit chilly in Dallas, too. Of course, everything is relative, but it's 45 degrees in Detroit. You know, they're playing the World Series. 45 degrees. I've never understood how you can play baseball at when it's 45. Even if the money they make, I understand that, but it's tough to play baseball when it's 45. You know, you have a very hard time gripping the ball. It's just not it's not good for the game when it's that cold. But I guess
your nerves don't work too well in the cold. That get that from shoveling and snow blowing. But you know, you pay me a couple million, I'll go run in ice water if you want to.
No, you're right. I mean, I understand, and the ball players are used to it. But I actually think the biggest thing is the fans who've got to sit there for a couple of hours. And
remember the Ice Bowl back in Green Bay, though? You
oh,
were
sure, sure.
You may have been. Were you around when that was? That was
yes,
what,
I, that was 67. Yeah, I remember a little bit
yeah.
of that.
Yeah, was below zero.
Well, that was that. Yeah, you're right. That was the Packers and the Cowboys, and that was actually I think that was the last real NFL championship before they merged. Yeah, it was Cowboys and it was minus 17, but they said it was like 30 below actually on the field. And you can get that video, by the way. I saw that video. One time I rented the video, and it has the whole game, and you can just see how cold it was. It was just an absolutely deadly day up there in Green Bay. But they played it, and it became one of the real classics in NFL history. But let's talk about your book, Worthless. I thought it was interesting today that an article came out in the Huffington Post out of Detroit, out of Florida, where the state of Florida is actually going to give tuition assistance or charge tuitions based on the degree. I thought that was kind of an interesting, interesting thing. It kind of ties into your book, don't you think?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's an outstanding development. They're going to charge more for the worthless degrees, and they're going to charge less for the worthwhile degrees. And I don't know exactly the metric on how they're going to scale it or how they're going to determine what to charge and what to subsidize. But it's great because it's adhering to the market. And my personal philosophical economic opinion is that, you know, we shouldn't be in the business of educating anyway. The government should be out of it. Leave that up to the private markets. But if we're going to do it, let's tailor our policies towards generating engineers, doctors, tradesmen, computer type people, stuff that the economy needs and is going to result in jobs for these kids, rather than essentially 100% financing themselves a little bit of a hobby that is going to produce nothing in the end except give them warm fuzzies for 4 years and pay an overpaid professor, you know, $100,000 a year to teach, you know, his hobby as well.
In fact, one of the quotes from the article, and I'm going to put a link. I think you put a link on your blog today, didn't you? About because I noticed that in your blog today that you put a link or you wrote an article about this article. And one of the quotes, Aaron, one of the quotes was from one of the students, I think, who said, "Well, you don't have as much." As, I'm paraphrasing, but the student said, "It's you don't have as much of a chance of getting a good-paying job if you have an English degree or something like that."
He went on to say that these people are going to make more, referring to the engineers, so they should be paying more. And it just socialist, mindless claptrap from an idiotic 22-year-old kid.
No, you're exactly right. This kid was saying, you know, gee, I'm going to make less money when I graduate. This guy's going to make more money then. Therefore, he should pay more for his degree. Shouldn't it be the other way around?
Well, it shows you why this kid's economics teacher should have been shot. I mean, this kid, he doesn't know how the real world works. It's not everybody makes a lot of money and then those who make less we redistribute, although that is how it happens with the government policy. But that's not going to last forever. What you're talking about is an unsustainable system and the naivete on the part of these children, veritable children, who don't know how economics works. And, if you know, think about the incentives that provides the engineering students. What engineering student is going to say, oh, so I'm going to try twice as hard earning a degree that's twice as hard as your theater degree or whatever, and then I'm going to pay the additional taxes so I can subsidize you to go dance in a tutu or do interpretive dance and not make any real money and heck, probably end up having to pay even more taxes to subsidize some kind of government make-work program for this kid to have some kind of employment. So it's not only displays the true ignorance about economics, but selfishness and naivete of most of these liberal arts students.
Exactly. You're exactly right. One of the points you make in your book, and we're talking to Aaron Cleary, the author of the book Worthless, one of the points you make in your book is that one of the reasons that we have all these graduates is because the government is basically subsidizing these loans. I mean, we're making it possible for people to borrow money with a government guarantee so that they can go out and get a degree in poetry in the northern provinces of Italy in the 13th century. Now, I have nothing against that. I want the listeners to understand that if that's what you want to do in life, if you want to get a PhD in 13th century poetry in the north of Italy, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that. As long as you pay for it, as long as you, you know, you borrow the money yourself and you're not asking taxpayers to help you with it. That's just,
right.
That's where I draw the line.
Well, and you can kind of see this with that 22-year-old kid and the howls coming from the liberal arts majors, is it shows that they have an entitlement mentality. Like somehow I owe it to them to not only pay for it or subsidize their education, but to provide an additional governmental guarantee via the taxpayer myself so that they can go and get some kind of worthless degree. No, if it's going to be my money, taxpayer money, it should be a genuine investment, and there should be a rate of return. I should expect a rate of return on every penny I give to the government. This is it, what it really is, and it's even more insulting than welfare. You take somebody who's on welfare, and let's assume they're illegitimately on it. They know they're screwing over the system. They're working the system. Okay, I have more respect for that veritable thief because they know what they're doing. What these kids are doing is not only taking welfare, but it's welfare in the form of boosting their ego so that they can go to college and claim that they're intelligent or they're getting educated. It's their right. And then they get to go ahead and parade around, well, I'm an artist or I am a musician. Well, I have my master's degree in whatever, you know, English or Hispanic Americans, you name it, whatever it is. So what we're really doing, since there's no economic return, there's nothing that we're going to get out of it. And there's no real reason for these kids to do it. They could learn the stuff getting, going and getting the language software. Just, you know, if you want to get a degree in philosophy, go to the library and read for free. Your employment prospects will be the same. What we're really doing is just paying for these kids' egos. That's what really irks me.
Right, and we're doing so, but we've reached the point now, and this is one of the points you make in the book as well. We've reached the point now where we can no longer afford to do this. I mean, that
correct.
Our country, you know, we're $16 trillion in debt. We're running budget deficit of 10% of GDP. I mean, at some point, you run out of money. At some point, your checks, is, you know, as I always, I think you use the example of the Chinese are not going to lend us any more money. Well, yeah, that's going to happen at some point. At some
yep.
point, you know, we're going to pick up the phone and call the Chinese chairman, and he's going to say, I'm sorry, we just can't do it anymore. Not because they don't want to, but because they really don't have the money themselves.
Well,
I mean,
they have the money, but why would they? I mean, what we got to do, we're not that much different than Greece. Everyone, well, we're not as bad as Greece. Yeah, we're not as bad, but we're literally, if you look at the numbers in terms of, you know, our deficits as a percentage of GDP, our debt as a percentage of GDP and other things, we're about 80, 85% there. And if you were, and a lot of people get confused when you look at international finance on countrywide levels. What you got to look at it is, basically bring it down to an individual level, you're looking at a person who spends about 10% more than they make every year. They have debt equivalent to 100% of their salary in the year, and that does not attest to private debt either. That's 300% if we include corporate and personal debt. The United States is a financial deadbeat, and I know. I worked in banking, and I've seen it. I've seen deadbeats all over the place. China will cut the funds, as will the Arabs and the Indians and all of our other international creditors. And then the party's over. The cash flow will end, and then the government's going to have no other option but to either default or inflate the currency. But regardless, the effect for that, for these worthless degrees, it's going to be over. It's going to be done. There's not going to be any more money unless they print, which will cause hyperinflation so that people can continue having their little egos and hobbies.
But at some point, their degrees will be worthless because you could have you can have inflated money, but that doesn't make you rich. You know,
no.
I mean, at some point, I'll just kind of give you a quick example. You know, my parents like to watch some of these game shows from Latin America and on the Spanish TV. You know, all these crazy game shows like to make a deal and all of that. And a few years ago, the Mexican peso was like 3,000, 4,000 to one. A dollar. And so when these people would win money in the Mexican show, it would be like, oh, you've won 50 million pesos. And my mom would say, wow, you know, wow, they won. And of course, I said to my mom, yeah, but that's like $5,000. She goes,
right.
Oh, okay, it's not 50 million pesos. No, it's just that's just an overvalued, you know, currency. So it doesn't
right.
make you richer. It just, you know, it just puts more papers in your wallet, but it doesn't make you richer.
Right. What we're talking about is purchasing power, and that's what's ultimately going to determine the value of a degree. An engineer who has a sought-after skill, it doesn't matter what the inflation rate is, his employers or her employers are going to have to pay whatever the prevailing rate is in terms of currency. So if inflation goes up 100%, that engineer has a value of her skill that's going to command a wage that's been inflated by 100%. The English major is still going to make effectively today $8 an hour because that's all they really can offer in terms of the value of the skill. It may be $8 an hour today. You have 100% inflation in a year. It might be $16 next year. But the purchasing power is what's going to determine the value of a degree.
That's right. And the book is called Worthless. And I thought maybe, Aaron, if you could take a couple of minutes. And how long did it take you to write the book? I'm just curious.
2 weeks.
Okay, so you had, I guess you must have had a lot of these ideas already thought about or maybe written out different drafts?
I had written about, I've been on the, I mean, not to brag, but I've been writing about the worthless degree angle for about, since maybe 2007, 2008. And, you know, it came to a head, and I was living out in Wyoming at the time, and I don't know, depending on where you live in Wyoming, it's either really cool like Jackson where, you know, Yellowstone and the Grand Tetons are, or the rest of the state, which is pretty much horrible. And so not a lot of social activity going on in Wyoming, and I ended up just hammering it out over the course of two weeks of evenings. And but, yeah, I knew what I wanted to say, and it was just simply a matter of outlining it and kind of putting it together. Plus, I had done a lot of the research for the charts and the data previously before. It was simply a matter of going through my blog archives and pulling those charts and data to put it together. So it was a pretty quick book.
Now, as far as what got you to write the book, were you having contact directly or indirectly with college students and just sort of, you know, running into them socially or whatever and maybe having a drink with a friend who couldn't find a job? And you said,
What it was is, you know, if you get bored one of these days, go on YouTube and you can look up my series on Crusaderism. And what I noticed a while ago is how the I don't know any other way to put it. The most evil people that we have running the country today, the most evil, despicable, worthless people we have are people with worthless degrees. And I did a chart a while ago, and I looked at the Minnesota State Legislature. And I figured out, I went and looked up all the profiles and saw what they majored in back in college. And it was something like it was a drastic number, like 90 or 95%, I'll have to double check it again, have their degrees in worthless fields. And what it did is it set me down the path to figure out, okay, why is this, what's happening here? And I ended up figuring out what it's called, and I termed it Crusaderism. And what it is in short, you have these people, they usually come from upper middle income or rich backgrounds. They don't want to really try. They don't want to produce anything that takes rigor or effort. And so what they do is they go and major in fluff. And that's the first sign of kind of telling the world, I want the rest of the world to support me. I'm going to produce nothing of value, but I want all the engineers to make me an iPad. I want all the engineers to run the electricity. I want all the tradesmen to run me cable while I'm going to go write poetry and live off of my trust fund. And then what these people do is they get bored, and they got to do something beyond just sitting on their duff all day collecting a trust fund check. So they go and they run for public office. And this is it's insane how accurate this prediction is. You can go to any legislature, any politician, almost any politician. You're not going to see a lot of engineers or accountants. You're going to see, more often than not, lawyers who couldn't make it into a real law firm with an undergrad in some kind of fluff like rhetoric or philosophy or what have you. And it was my hatred for these people and how they think they're better than everybody else and that they have no real world experience that they then determine that they're going to go run for office when it has nothing to be as noble as being a statesman or helping out the fellow American. They're doing it because they can't find another job or they refuse to work a real job. And
right.
So that's where I started to have this visceral disgust for people with worthless degrees and then triggered the book.
Yeah, interesting. Aaron Cleary, the book is Worthless. We have a link in the show information to the book. You can also go to Aaron's website, Caps in Capitalism. You can also get the book there. You can go to Amazon and just put in Aaron Cleary, Clarey, Worthless, and it'll pop right there. And it's available in print. It's also available in Kindle, right? Is that what they call it when you bring the book down right into your computer? I'm not
That's what they call it. Yes, that's $13 so paperback and $5 Kindle. Correct.
Yeah, I mean you can actually sit there and just buy the book and within a few minutes you've got the book in your computer. I mean that's actually a pretty good deal. I mean that's I mean that makes it for. Makes it for reading, but we're going to be doing a show with Aaron in the next couple of weeks, where we're going to bring in some students and we're going to be talking with you. I'm putting together. I've got a couple of people here in Texas that we're trying to put together. A lot of people are very busy with the election now. A lot of students, so we may do it after the election, Aaron. But we want to do a show where we have college students participate in the roundtable. I think that's going to be a lot of fun for you, and it's going to be a lot of fun for them. I've got several of them who are already reading the book, so hopefully they'll be able to ask you some pretty good questions when they join the program. As I say, we'll do it in the next couple of weeks, probably after the election, because we'll have a little bit more room for that kind of a program after the election. Right now we're pretty wrapped up on the election, which, by the way, well, one last commentary here, it's looking pretty good for Romney, isn't it?
It is. I'm a little fearful about the Democrats cheating, and as I always am. But if 2010 and the Scott Walker election are any kind of indication, I don't think cheating is going to be able to overcome this. I really believe, and I don't know if you got the link I sent you about black elementary school children singing songs for Romney. And all this anecdotal evidence. I mean, it's bad. The guy ain't cool anymore. He's lost his luster. The emperor has no clothes. I hate to say this because I don't want to be so optimistic, but I think it's going to be a Mondale Reagan landslide. I think Romney's going to. I think California and Minnesota might go with Obama. It wouldn't surprise me even if Michigan goes with Romney.
Yeah. Well, I think Michigan is looking better all the time. I hear Pennsylvania is looking better. I think that it'll be somewhat like in 2000, my guess, if I had to make a prediction, I think it'll be like 2004 when Bush got about 300 electoral votes and maybe a little bit more, something like 52-47 in the popular vote. I kind of feel that way because he's going to get a lot of votes out of California, and that's really going to inflate the popular vote. But I do think Romney's going to win. I think it looks a lot better all the time. Obama is really depreciated, devalued. As you indicated, there's just nothing there. And when you're running TV ads, Aaron, talking about the first time that you vote for somebody and connecting that with reproductive rights, you know you're in real trouble.
Well, and I think a lot of people are just burnt out. He didn't turn the economy around like he said he was going to.
Right.
And, he's a spectacular failure. And I don't say that as a partisan. I say it because that's what he is. And
he
is such a letdown for his loyal base. They're not. I hope they're not going to turn out. I don't know how they can. I really don't. And it's kind of like the really cool popular kid. He comes in and then you find out, I don't know, that I'm trying to make an analogy that isn't coming to me, but, you know, he kicks kittens or something.
You're right.
He's just not cool.
There was so much promise. I use the analogy, and then we got to go. But I say it's like during the campaign, every time the prince kissed Snow White, she woke up. But since he became president, every time he kisses her, she stays dead.
Yeah.
And I think it's something like that. It just the magic is gone. There is no magic anymore. Well, that's going to do it for tonight, Aaron. Thank you so much for joining us. It's always a pleasure to have you on, and we'll do it again. We got to keep talking about this great book of yours.
Wonderful. Yeah, let me know when those kids are on, and I'll get some kids to call in as well, all right?
All right. Good night, Aaron.
All right, have a good night.
Good night up in Aaron, Minnesota. Our thanks to Jim Yarley for being on the first segment. We talked about Libya, and we talked a little bit about foreign policy. And, of course, in our second segment, my good friend Aaron Cleary up in Minnesota talking about his book called Worthless, and you can check out the book in the show information. It's a fascinating book. You're going to learn a great deal about what's happening in public education. This is higher education, I should say. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas. I hope everybody has a good weekend. And I'm just going to say, go Tigers. But frankly, the Tigers are not doing very well tonight. I think our friend Leslie Eastman is probably going to be very disappointed with their Tigers. They're not winning. They're not winning, Leslie. Your Tigers are not winning. They're going to be down 3-0, it looks like, tonight in the World Series. Good night, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.